Hi, everybody. Good to see you all. Haven't seen Chris in a long time. Welcome home. You've been home for a while, I guess, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I tried to get here last week and had my husband's keys in the car. I had to turn around.
Oh, dear. And he just had a birthday. And I haven't seen Jeff in a while. Hi, Jeff. Well, I'm going to start off on page 90. Read you a story from Ayama Roshi. The title of this section is Magnanimous Mind. The Zen term Kanshiketsu literally means shit stick. In China, a monk calling on Zen master Yunman asked, "What is Buddha?" And Yunman replied, "A dried shit stick." Very famous case. When the abbot or any of the teachers is away from the temple for a week or so, the novices think nothing of it. But if there were no toilet paper, they would feel quickly its absence. They wouldn't last a week, right? And it wouldn't last a day. Shit sticks, which were used in former days for the same purpose, could be washed and used any number of times. Shit sticks became dirty to clean us. If they are not Buddhas, what is? Out of gratitude for them, I recognize the shit stick as a Buddha. And this makes me wonder whether if I were given a filthy task, I would be able to tackle it with the same attitude that I would deal with any of the duties of abbess. Would I happily take pride in it? I would probably complain, compare it unfavorably with other work, and be tormented by a feeling of inferiority. Zen master Kosho Uchiyama said, "Violets are violets, roses are roses, budding, blossoming, fading, aging, becoming deceased, all stages. As we go through these stages ourselves, let us bloom and grace the present moment of eternity." All of that was Kosho Uchiyama Roshi. And then Ayama Roshi comments, "In the mundane world, there are countless roles and degrees of status. In the world of truth, the world of the Buddha, however, nothing is useless. Everything is equally important, irreplaceable, and precious. Nothing is inessential. If there were no toilet paper, we would not get through the day. If a garbage truck did not come around once in a while, we would be in serious trouble. Getting smeared with excrement or covered with dirt is the ultimate form of Buddhahood. We may think we understand this, but when it is our turn to get our hands dirty, we end up complaining." Yoshio Toi, the Buddhist monk, frequently gave a talk entitled "Bowing to the Soles of People's Feet." On one occasion, another lecturer approached him afterward, bowed to the soles of his feet, and began massaging them, saying, "Reverend Toy, when you return home, please bow to the soles of your wife's feet and massage them like this." So Reverend Toy did so, and later told us his thoughts about the experience. He said, "It had been over 20 years since we were married, and yet this was the first time I had ever seen the soles of my wife's feet. I was shocked to find how rough and misshapen they were. Then it came to me, my wife, who was born in a city temple, undoubtedly had much nicer feet when she first came to my temple as a young bride. In my place, she would always inspect the fields, function as the caretaker of the temple, and go out on any errands. She shouldered all the rough work at our poor temple up in the mountains, tilling the fields and gardens, carrying heavy bags on her back. Her feet had suffered as she trudged among the rocks and tree roots on mountain paths. Realizing the truth of this, I bowed to them and massaged them in earnest." And it is true, you know, in Buddhist temples in Japan, temple wives, usually they're born into it, like he mentions here in passing. His wife was born in a temple. You know, she would never have gotten involved, you know, in marrying a priest if she didn't already come from that. because it's very hard work, and women do all the work. You know, the men run around and they look nice and they bow and they chant, and the women actually do all the work, as we all find when we go to Rinso Inn. We see that Chitose is really the one who takes care of the temple and does all the work. Anyway, have we ever seriously examined, bowed to, or appreciated in any way the soles of our feet, which have done all the work of sustaining the body, always bearing the brunt of our walking? Even if we did, would we truly discover their worth without comparing them to other parts of the body and enjoy work that requires us to assume a role similar to the soles of our feet? They support the whole body. If they are not Buddha, what is? But even this kind of discernment is delusion. True commitment to one's role has no room for thoughts like these. Zen Master Dogen says in Tenzo Kyokan, when making a soup with ordinary greens, do not be carried away by feelings of dislike toward them, nor regard them lightly. Neither jump for joy simply because you have been given ingredients of superior quality to make a special dish. That's the end of the quote from Tenzo Kyokan. He reprimanded those who would scorn a simple vegetable soup and make a full effort only for a special feast, that is, those whose speech and attitude depend on the people or materials involved. In the last part of the text, concerning the three minds, he wrote, magnanimous mind is like a mountain, stable and impartial. Exemplifying the ocean, it is tolerant and views everything from the broadest perspective. Having a magnanimous mind means being without prejudice and refusing to take sides. That's the end of the quote. To do anything that Buddhist practice requires, happily and with concentrated devotion, without entertaining likes or dislikes, whether it involves cleaning shit sticks, performing an abbess's duties, making a simple vegetable soup, or preparing a great feast, this is called magnanimous mind. So, it's a wonderful passage. Her discussion of the shit stick koan, I think, is really interesting, because usually, you know, I think many of us have heard this story before, what is Buddha, shit stick, and when you hear that story, you think, oh, you know, those rascal Zen masters giving absurd eschatological answers. It's just, you know, that's Zen for you. Provocative, you know, and outrageous. But here, she actually, like, talks about a shit stick and how it was used and why it really is a valuable and important thing. How practical it is and how important it is. Today, we would, you know, it'd be toilet paper, which is a great invention. I mean, let's all bow to the person who figured out that you could have toilet paper. It's a wonderful idea, really, you know, that probably for a long time people, nobody thought of this. So thank you to the toilet paper inventor and the many companies that manufacture toilet paper and the people who ship it and offer it in the stores. I personally am grateful for this invention. And surely it's true, you know, toilet paper must be, if not like the Buddha itself, then at least a gift from the Buddha.
And from the many trees.
What?
And from the many trees,
right. Now, the teaching that she gives here about magnanimous mind that she quotes Dogen at the end, this comes from our dear A. Robin's favorite text, Tenzo Kyokan. If A. Robin ever gives a Dharma talk, you can be sure it'll be about the Tenzo Kyokan. And in that text, she mentions the three minds. Here she only talks about one of the three minds, magnanimous minds, but the three minds are, Dogen says, the Tenzo, the head cook, should have three kinds of mind: joyful mind, parental mind, and magnanimous mind. And I was thinking about this. It's possible that knowing about these three kinds of minds is the only thing that you actually need to know about Zen practice. Maybe the rest of it is all just like fluff. The basic thing is these three minds. Joyful mind, to always come back to joy, to gratitude, you know, that you're alive, that you could, whatever it is that you're doing or whatever it is you're suffering, thank God you're suffering it because you're living, you're alive. Without life, the joy of being alive, you're not going to suffer this or enjoy this thing that's in front of you. So to always come back to joy and gratitude and lightheartedness, even when things are tough, not to avoid the difficulty, but also not to be capsized by it, to remember that everything is actually joy, because everything, even the troubles, are always liberated. Every problem, as I always say, you know, has within it its own solution, and also the next problem and its solution, and on, you know, forever, joyfully. And this is the process of living and dying that we love. Joyful mind, and then parental mind, which means being concerned for everything and everyone in just the way, exactly the way that a parent is concerned for a child, which involves a certain amount of suffering and, you know, unhappiness. You know, as some of you know, one of our sons is having trouble these days, complications in his life, and I'm just so moved by my wife's, she thinks about him every single day, and every day tries to get his attention. She should call and let us know how he's doing and stuff like that. The parental mind is really inspiring, especially probably mother mind more than father mind. And then this third one, a magnanimous mind, as she writes in her version of Dogen. Her English is different from some of the other translations you can read, but her version of magnanimous mind, a mind that receives everything equally without saying this is good, this is bad, I like this, I don't like that, just receiving everything equally and appreciating everything equally. And I really think that if you could appreciate these three minds and always try to practice them, that would pretty much be the whole thing of Soto Zen practice. And they do describe the kind of effort we want to make and the attitude that we aspire to, and the rest is all gravy, you know. I was flying home from Florida the other day when I was with my relatives, you know. I told you my cousin passed away, and so I went there and went to the funeral and the Shiva, the morning time. And on the way home in the airplane, I had to read another book, because I am always, they're asking me to make a little blurb, you know, and I feel I should read the book, you know, if I'm going to say this is a great book, at least I should read it. So on the airplane on the way home, I was reading another book, which is called Magnanimous Heart, meaning it's the same, magnanimous mind. She just uses, because, you know, the word for mind could be translated as heart. It's the same word, mind, heart, same word. So she calls her book Magnanimous Mind, and the author of the book is Narayan Helen Liebenson, who's a friend of mine and one of the founding teachers of the Cambridge Buddhist Association in Massachusetts. And she takes the title, as she says, from the Dogen teaching. And in her book, when she quotes the quotation about magnanimous mind, she uses these, she doesn't actually attribute it to Aoyama Roshi, but it's her, Aoyama Roshi's English, as translated by my friend Diane Benaj, I told you about last time. And in the book, she talks about meeting Aoyama Roshi, and she tells a little story about when she met her. She said that she, Narayan, at that time, was on her way to a three-month Vipassana retreat. And as you know from yourself having been or being a Vipassana student or knowing Vipassana students, they are really focused on long retreats, because on a long retreat, you can make a lot of progress. So, you know, it's a really big deal to go on a long retreat. And Narayan was thinking about this. And so she asked Aoyama Roshi for advice about how she should practice in the retreat. And Aoyama Roshi's only advice to her was, just come back more like yourself. And Narayan, who was looking for, you know, some really good meditation instructions, was quite disappointed, you know, by this answer. And she thought about it for a while, and she realized that she was going to this 3-month retreat expecting to come back a different person. That was why she was going to the 3-month retreat, because she felt like she needed to be another person. You know, the person she was not quite up to snuff. So that's the point of going to a 3-month retreat, so you can come back and be a different person. But Aoyama Roshi, I guess, was gently trying to tell her, well, you know, that's not really the spirit. Why don't you realize that you are, like everyone else, already as you are a Buddha. And what you need to do is not become somebody else. You just need to, like, remember, recognize, you know, who and what you really are and embrace that, and then you'll be fine. So while I'm telling you about Narayan's book, which I don't even know when it's going to come out, sometime in the future. Anyway, I learned two terms that I really was impressed. I'll share this with you. I really didn't know these two terms from the Pali. One of them is called Samvega. Samvega, maybe some of you know this. It was an unfamiliar word to me. It means spiritual urgency. It's like the chant we always say in the Zen monastery in the afternoon before the relaxed schedule day. We chant, practice as though your head's on fire, as though you were a fish in a little puddle. Practice with urgency. It's a serious matter. To be alive is to be in a perilous situation. We're in a perilous situation, every one of us, individually and collectively. We're really in the soup, as we know. So we should be practicing with a sense of, you know, urgency, bordering on desperation, perhaps. The other term is pasada. Pasada. It balances samvega. It means confidence in the unconditioned. Confidence that we can and we will, and we already are beyond the desperate conditions of our life. So this is sort of the characteristic of, you know, the effort we want to make in practice. This is really right effort, balancing on the one hand a sense of urgency and seriousness and gravity of the situation we're in, and on the other hand, confidence, faith that basically we're okay and this is going to be just as it needs to be. Samvega and pasada. I think this is the right spelling. The way Samvega, Samvega, Posada. I think that's the right spelling. So I don't know if you noticed it, but several times, I don't know how many times throughout the course of Aoyama's talks in this book, she talks about praying. It's not a topic, but she mentions it a number of times. I prayed for this and I prayed for that. And I don't know if you were startled by that, but actually it's very commonplace in Chinese and Japanese Zen. They're always praying for various things spontaneously. I pray for this, I pray for that when something happens. Sometimes they pray out of gratitude, you know, thankfulness to the Buddha for the gift of life. Sometimes in times of need, they pray to the Buddha. Sometimes when they see the suffering of another, they pray to the Buddha that the person would be well. The reason it might have been seem strange to some of you, because it's not so much the culture of Western Zen, which tends to be in flight from our traditions in which prayer occurs. So we think of it as being, you know, a psychological, rational practice. We, there's nobody to pray to. You know, what are we doing? It's ridiculous. And we emphasize us and our, you know, intelligence and diligence and practice. We will get enlightened. We will overcome suffering by our own efforts. That tends to be sort of more the attitude in American or Western Buddhism. But this is changing, I think. I think as we're all getting older and more enfeebled, we're realizing that maybe there's something to this Asian perspective. You know, maybe we should stop thinking that we're going to, at this point, like, are we really going to overcome who we are? Probably not, you know. Probably we should pray to Buddha to make things nice for us and help us out as we go along. Anyway, here's a passage that speaks about that. It's in a section called Hearing the Wind in the Pines, but I'm not reading the whole section. I'm starting here at the top of page 55. Beautiful, to me, beautiful discussion of this. Not of prayer per se, but of the spirit behind praying. We cannot see or hear autumn or hold autumn in our hands. But when the leaves turn red and the ears of rice turn golden, they signal the arrival of autumn. When we hear the crickets chirping at night or an autumn shower striking the eaves or pink ripe apples and persimmons, we embrace autumn. Autumn becomes something to savor. The life and voice of the Buddha is everywhere in heaven and earth and is manifested in all things. As art historian Muneyoshi Yanagi wrote in his last years in his book Shinge, which means Verses of the Heart, Buddha is the name of something nameless. The life of the Buddha originally had neither name nor form and is in everything, from a tree or a blade of grass to a tile or a stone. It becomes the wind in the pines or in a sail. It is born as man or woman. It is in good and evil, beauty and ugliness. Whatever form something takes, it manifests the Buddha. The magically gifted monkey in 16th century China's great comic novel could not leave the palm of the Buddha's hand, nor can we. Whenever I am so arrogant as to think that I have the power to give myself life, I think of this poem by a 5-year-old child. The moment I say, "Tongue, speak," my tongue has moved. When I told my tongue to speak, who moved it? The power that moves my tongue before I do is a power that works without rest when I sleep and makes a flower bloom or a horse neigh. Whether we know it or not, the Buddha holds us in the palm of his hand, and he is the power that gives us life. To symbolize and revere that power, people have given artistic form to what originally was without name or form by carving images of Buddha, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in human form. In a way, in the way a child sometimes needs to call its mother, we call on Amida Buddha or Kanon Bodhisattva. Then everything is revealed as Amida or as transformations of Kanon. On a hot summer day on Mount Maku in China, Zen Master Baoje sat fanning himself. A young Zen monk approached him and said, "The nature of wind is everywhere. There is no place it is not. Why do you use a fan?" The master answered, "Although you know that the nature of wind is everywhere, you do not yet know the nature of there being no place it is not." The young monk asked, "Then what is the nature of there being no place it is not?" And the Zen master didn't say anything. Just kept fanning himself. Silently fanning oneself is a valuable practice. And many of you will know that that little story is the ending of Dogen's great text, Genjo Koan. He ends the text with that story of the fanning. So she comments on it. However well we understand that we manifest the life of the Buddha, we cannot realize our full potential unless we practice the Buddha's teachings. So Dogen uses that quote to illustrate that enlightenment is practice, and practice is enlightenment. If we really understand that everything is Buddha and the whole world is a gift to us, what we do in response to that is practice. And if we don't practice, we won't really appreciate and understand that truth, even though it will still be true for us. As she says, we won't realize our full potential unless we practice. Practice brings out, brings home to us what is already the case and what is the case for everyone else. So in some very real way, we don't have to practice. There's no point. We don't get anything out of it. But on the other hand, we practice because we appreciate what we are, and our practice manifests that appreciation so much more strongly, even though it's still the case no matter what. As she says, still, the life of the Buddha is manifested in us regardless of whether we understand or are aware of it or practice the Buddha's teachings. It is manifest in us as we go about our daily lives. For instance, when we conserve water or plant life or tackle our household chores wholeheartedly, whether a dewdrop is on a flower or a heap of dung, the morning light sparkles on it just the same. What a joy it is to know that our finite lives are part of the infinite lives of the Buddha. About 200 years ago, the folklore scholar Shugei Masumi visited Muryoji Temple, where I live, and dedicated this poem to our principal image of Amida Buddha. And this is the poem. When I asked about the immeasurable age of the Buddha, in the presence of the Buddha, answer came from the wind in the pines. Every time I read this poem, my heart is renewed, and I strain to hear the wind in the pines, feeling I must live every moment in a way that creates wind in the pines. A lovely passage and wonderful way she has of thinking about life. One more story of hers I'll read. Savor each moment in life. Page 95. The taxi driver was grumbling. This kind of work is pretty worthless, and I know it's all I'll ever do with my life. I guess if you're a priest and you're driving in a taxi cab, the taxi driver is very likely to unburden himself on you. That's the trouble with going around, as she probably does, you know, wearing all priest clothes all the time, then everybody will tell you everything that's on their mind. So the cab driver says that to her, and she, quite spontaneously, I retorted, "Your job is certainly not worthless. You become both arms and legs for people, carrying them where they need to go. People like me could never manage without you. An understanding driver always goes as close to the speed limit as he can go to get me to my destination on time. Even though I'm forever going about here and there, I never bothered to take an umbrella with me. And the driver kindly shields me from the rain, taking me right up to the place I want to go. He also helps me to carry my bags, because I always walk about with as much hand luggage as a person leaving on a trip. And whereas I have no natural sense of direction, the taxi driver will find his way through winding lanes, asking directions where necessary." Well, of course, today they don't ask directions. They have their iPhone. "Taxi drivers safely deliver home those who missed the last train because their meeting was delayed or because they were out drinking too late. When a person has to get to a hospital suddenly, A taxi driver can be a lifesaver when no one else can take you where you have to go because everyone is on holiday or it's the dead of night. One can always rely on the taxi driver. Don't you agree that this is wonderful work, after all? As I had him taking me quite a distance, I continued. I seriously believe that there is not one worthless thing, not a single useless thing in the whole world. The other day I gave a lecture at a company that manufactures watches and calculators. When the lecture was over, the company president took me on a tour of the factory, and I was really impressed. I watched parts being assembled that can be seen only with a microscope and on a conveyor belt at that. If one of those parts, being poked around by the point of a needle, is out of place to the tiniest extent, the entire watch, the entire calculator, will be out of sync or could stop altogether. I felt very keenly how each single part shouldered the work of the entire piece. And I thought that one household, or to widen the image a bit, a society or country, or to widen the image even further, heaven and earth, and even the universe itself, function in the very same way as one of these watches. Most people see things in terms of superior and inferior, higher and lower values, but seen from the standpoint of truth, there are neither superior nor inferior nor higher nor lower values. No matter where you begin, the entire family, the entire society, the entire universe is fully in place at every single point. The perspective alters quite dramatically if we are alert enough to see the difference between the biased view that our work is merely one trifling mechanical part and the attitude that whatever we do, it shoulders all heaven and earth, all past, present, and future. When Shakyamuni, this cab driver is getting quite a... When Shakyamuni Buddha was born, he pointed to heaven with one hand and to earth with another. You might have heard that he said, "I alone am honored in heaven and on earth." As we'll see, you know, when we have our Buddha's birthday, you know, that's what the Buddha says. He meant... It sounds like he's saying, you know, forget everybody, I'm the boss. But actually what he meant was, all sentient beings have value. No matter what person, what kind of work, what flower or bird, they all have received the great gift of life from heaven and earth, whether they realize it or not. And that ends the speech to the cab driver. And she now says, I suppose it was presumptuous to talk about these things to the driver for so long, but he listened, seriously, and I was glad to hear him say, "Well, what you've said gives me hope. I'll try to do my best." Zen Master Suedo said, and this I think is a commentary, I know this poem well, it's a commentary poem to one of the cases in Wycliffe Record, 1735. "The truth you search for cannot be grasped. As night advances, a bright moon illuminates the whole ocean. The dragon's jewel is found in every wave. Looking for the moon, it is here, in this wave, in the next." 1735 is supposed to suggest life's unpredictability. Anything can happen. Life does not follow a set pattern. If we wonder where truth is hidden or whether we can find worthwhile work, we will restlessly look beyond ourselves. But just as the moonlight glitters on the crest of every wave, everything and every person is important and has his or her own splendor. Not a single thing is insignificant. That is why Zen Master Dogen taught in the Tenzo Kyoken and Fushoku Hampo, which is the text where he talks about etiquette, meal etiquette for monks, and particularly in the sections entitled Washing the Face and Rules for the Bathroom in Shobo Genzo. So that's true, you know, the profound Shobo Genzo with all these, you know, like abstruse philosophical texts also has these other texts like how to wash your face, how to use the lavatory, the rules like that in the Zen monastery. So this is another... kind of unexpected Zen teaching. we talk so much about, depth of meditation practice. We talk so much about taking care of other people, about being concerned for the world. And there are a lot of people who practice Dharma or other spiritual traditions who focus their lives on doing good works, maybe political work or charity work or helping profession, all kinds of ways to help people. And of course, this kind of work is important, and we should all do it when the inclination and the opportunity for it arises. But to think that some work is helping work and other work is not helping work, not noble work, not beneficial work, not work in service of others, is a big mistake, as she says. All work, all activity is helpful and necessary. And I'm thinking, just the other day when I was in Florida, you have conversations with your relatives, and you get to know them, better than you usually do, because it's like the most boring thing in the world. You're sitting there all day long, doing anything, nothing, you don't watch TV or listen to the radio or do anything. You don't go out for a walk. You're just sitting there all day long. The only time you stir is when somebody says they brought food, and you get up and have some food. And sometimes they come around, they say, hand you a little bit of whiskey. Everybody's drinking whiskey, but just a little bit, a tiny bit. Every 3, 4, or 5 hours, a little tiny bit of whiskey. They dole it out. Anyway, I was sitting there talking to my nephew, Danny, and I didn't realize, he said, my dad was a CPA. He was an accountant. And he was really good at it, and he prepared a lot of taxes for a lot of people, and he said, and he was so good at it that he charged quite a lot of money. He made a lot of money because his fees were quite high. But if people couldn't afford the fee, he did not have a sliding scale or a cut rate. He just said, well, if you can't afford it, I'll just do it for free. So according to Danny, his dad had two kinds of customers, about equally divided. Customers who paid his fee and other customers who were free. He had about half of his business was free customers. So when he was telling me about that, it made me think of my friend Ralph, my tax guy, Ralph, who I just was talking to on the phone about an hour ago because I got a letter from the IRS that I owed them a huge amount of money in taxes. And I wasn't worried. I just called up Ralph and I said, Ralph, figure this out. Ralph immediately figures it out. Not that I don't have to pay the money, but I don't have to worry about it. Ralph worries about it. Ralph I've known for like 40 years. We were like literary buddies together. And every time I go to get my taxes done, we talk about the taxes and then we talk about what we're reading, and we read stuff to each other. It's very delightful. So Ralph really helps me. I am not that much for money. I realize lately, that I resent money. I resent that there's such a thing as money. I think it's a mistake. I really do. And I refuse to participate in it, which is a kind of neurotic, I recognize, not a reasonable idea. It's kind of neurotic. I'm not too proud of it. It's basically dysfunctional. And if I had to prepare my own taxes, this would be like an amazing, horrible suffering for me just because of my bad attitude. I would have to work at it, Fortunately, I don't have to work at it because I got Ralph. And I just, every year, hand Ralph a whole bunch of papers, which I don't know what they say or what's going on. I have no idea. And Ralph, just like magic, he just says, sign this, and that's all I have to do. Actually, Ralph, I would say, has helped me out in my life possibly more than any other single human being. Because taxes is a non-event, It doesn't exist. I don't even pay taxes. I just pay Ralph, And I was telling this to Ralph today. I said, Ralph, I'm going to give a Dharma talk tonight about you. And I told him what I was going to say. And I said, you can listen to it online. He said, I don't need to listen to it online. You just told me. He said, it brings tears to my eyes. Of course, he was joking. He's very cynical, Ralph. Actually, I have one more. One more. I forgot. This is a short one. It's on page 102. Again, I won't read the whole section. It's called The Gift of a Smiling Face. But I'm just going to read you one little part. So this is a story that I can't forget, she says. I heard it from the essayist Toru Matsui about a young Christian woman named Satoko Kitahara, the daughter of a professor. And this happened in a corner of downtown Tokyo that had been bombed to rubble during the Second World War. A shanty town called Ant Town, A-N-T, Ant Town, had sprung up there, where rag pickers lived. Satoko went to live there. She assembled the local children who were too poor to go to school, and she became their teacher. Often going without sleep, she also looked after the sick and elderly who lived alone. Every morning, several hundred rag pickers would go out, pulling their rattling wooden carts behind them. She would always see them off with a bright smile, saying, "Have a good day." In the evening, no matter how late the hour, she would always welcome them back with a smile, saying, "You must be tired." The mere sight of her gentle, innocent smile made these rough men, who had drifted to Ant Town in the post-war chaos, completely forget their weariness. Thus, Satoko came to be idolized as the Blessed Virgin of Ant Town. Eventually, she came down with tuberculosis. Although people urged her to go back to her parents' home to recover, she said, "Let me die here." In a corner of a hovel where a cold wind blew in through the cracks, she lay on a tattered mattress, taking neither medicine nor any special nourishment. She left the world while still young, in her 20s. After her death, a small notebook was found under her pillow. She had taken it out from time to time as she lay on her sickbed. So Matsui opened it up, and he found in the notebook just one sentence. "Aren't you forgetting to smile right now?" This reminds me of Simone Weil, who did something similar at the same time during the war in France. Last week, after the Dharma seminar, Kathy and I were discussing Aoyama's Roshi's teachings. Maybe you do that too after the seminar is over. You think about it more, you know, and you discuss it with your friends. I hope so. It'd be nice that you don't just forget about it. We think about it. So sometimes, though, you know, you hear it and then you think about it some more, and you think, it sounded good at the time, but the more I think about this, I'm not so sure, you know. So we have to, like, really think about these things and how we can practice with them. So last week, Kathy was complaining about the story of the woman that we read about who lied to her friend. Remember the woman who lied to her friend, saying, oh, her friend, you know, popped over to visit her, and she was about to go out. And instead of saying, oh, I was just about to go out, she said, oh, I was just returning. Please come in. I was just returning. And Kathy said, what's wrong with that person? Like, doesn't she call first? You know, she just shows up? And what kind of person just shows up at your house? I wouldn't like that if somebody just showed up at my house. And I certainly wouldn't lie to them and say, oh, how wonderful you're here. I was just coming back. I would tell them I'm going out. What is that? What's wrong with Aoyama Roshi? She thought it was really ridiculous. Anyway, you may have a problem. You may wonder about some of these teachings, like the one that I just read. You know, maybe if you got tuberculosis in the ant village, maybe you should go home, you know, to your mom and get better. You know, maybe, like, it's not the greatest thing in the world to die, even though you're dying in solidarity with the people you care about. It's noble and it's great, but is that the best way to go about things? To tell you the truth, I wouldn't do that. If it was me, you know, I think I would say, yeah, I'm going to go and get better, you know, then I'll come back and help you some more if I can. So maybe this kind of self-sacrifice is extreme, but of course this woman was a Catholic, and Catholics do practice extreme forms of self-sacrifice in imitation of Jesus, who also apparently did the same. And also Simone Weil was a Catholic too, so still, whether or not you think it's a good idea, it seems like it's somehow stirring to me and admirable. I don't like denigrate it. I think it's wow, you know, it's an amazing thing. I mean, after all, maybe it is better to die in solidarity with others when you could live longer. I mean, what's another decade or two of life after all? You know, life goes by so fast anyway. What's the difference if you die at 30, 40, 50, 70? What's the difference? Who knows? Anyway, it's a challenging example. I'm just saying all this as a way of saying that I understand, as I'm presenting these teachings to you, that there are many sides to them, and we may not necessarily think all of it is to be emulated. However, it's a good idea to be challenged, to have your usual notions challenged, and to ask yourself, well, I don't know, maybe it is a good idea to say, oh, I was just coming home. Maybe it is a good idea to die when the people all around you are in trouble, not leave them. I don't know. So that's what, let's discuss. Let's get in groups of three and discuss. But before we do that, I want to just, because I don't want to forget to say this, that next week we finish the book. And I was thinking that, how many of you have copies of the book, actually are reading it? A number of you. And of those of you who raised your hands, how many of you are going to be here next week? Not so many, huh? Okay. Well, what I wanted to do next week is to not say anything or choose any passages, but have the seminar be consisting of passages that you picked from the last section, so that we would then just start by having everybody who is prepared to do so to read the section that they've chosen and then say a few words about why it was meaningful to you. However, seeing that there are not so many hands there, I better come just in case with some passages, because I only saw really a few people who were definite that they have the book and they'll be here next week. But those of you who do have the book and will be here next week, please do that. Yeah, well, that's possible. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I mean, I'll come anyway, you know, but with some passages, just in case. But let's do it that way next week. We'll start off with, and we'll go as far as we can with what you have discovered. So I think tonight, let's get in groups of three and just have a kind of a more informal discussion for about 15 minutes or so about what you found, thought about in either in the passages that I just read or in something that you found in the book that you read. So let's just talk about whatever teachings are up for you and your questions about them, your thoughts about them, and just in an informal way. And then after about 15 minutes, that'll give us time, more time for a general discussion, which we didn't have time for last week. Okay? So everybody just being sensitive to everybody in the room and not choosing the usual suspects, go ahead and find two people.